Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What we might learn from Japan's lost decade. Nominees for the Nobel Prize in Economics, please. And also, Freakonomics, on the radio. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 5th of October, and we're going to take a little detour as we get going today. Dateline Tokyo, Japan. The Bank of Japan came out with a new plan to jumpstart that country's economy this morning, dropping interest rates to just about zero. Ought to sound familiar to you. The Federal Reserve has been holding its key interest rate near zero for almost 2 years now. By most accounts, that's the preferred treatment for an economy stuck in a lasting slump. But Japan has tried this medicine before, and it didn't go so well. So the somewhat frightening question becomes, who is copying whom? From New York, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has some answers.
This is the third time Japan has tried a zero interest rate policy since the 90s, but neither of the previous experiments worked. Takeo Hoshi is a professor of international economics at the University of California, San Diego. He says they didn't work because Japan pulled up the rug on the low rates too soon.
Each time they implemented the zero interest rate policy, they seemed to have stopped before the economy recovered.
U.S. policymakers know that, and they often cite Japan's lost decade as a reason not to fear low rates. The country stopped growing for years in the 90s. But if we're trying not to follow Japan, and Japan is now following us, then who are we following? I asked Dan Cook, senior market analyst at IG Markets.
It's kind of, in a way, you might say the blind leading the blind, because neither of us really have a great deal of successful experience with this. Hopefully, the U.S. can be a model moving forward. But so far, we haven't seen anything, and we still don't know the long-term ramifications.
And remember, long-term thinking often gives way to dealing with short-term crises on both sides of the Pacific. Fred Frankel is the vice chairman of Beacon Trust Company.
Everybody likes to put things in big long-term context, like Japan had a lost decade, they're going to continue to stagnate, and the policymakers there are just probably looking at what's going on right now, scratching their head, trying to figure out how do we stop this.
And since they've decided to go back to a zero interest rate policy, let's hope there's a Japanese translation for the term three times a charm. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Gold hit another high today atop $1,340 an ounce in New York. We should note that that is not the inflation-adjusted high. That would be about $2,300 an ounce. But the basic truth still applies here. When investors are uncertain, they turn to gold. And investors are uncertain. With so few profitable places to park one's cash these days, gold is looking like a pretty good way to get a decent return on your money. But otherwise, what's the draw? I mean, it's not like you can take it down to the corner bakery and buy a loaf of bread, right? Janet Babin has more.
Those gold earrings won't buy you a loaf of rye bread just yet. But there have been times when gold was the only thing that would get you that rye.
My mom grew up during World War II in Germany, and whatever assets they had after the bombings, that's how they got bread.
That's Anton Schutz, a portfolio manager with Burnham Financial Services. He says this latest bullion frenzy is being fueled by global uncertainty and fears of inflation. But he says there's another reason. More people are selling gold.
All those mortgage brokers that used to, you know, sell the mortgages that maybe got a lot of us into trouble are now working for firms that sell gold.
Schutz manages millions for Burnham, but the only gold he's bought is in his wife's jewelry box. And investors who are buying this time around want the actual physical bricks. J.P. Morgan said yesterday it would reopen an old gold vault. Futures trader John Thorpe is with Cannon Futures Trading.
People want something that they can hold on to, and gold over the history of time has been a tremendous store of value and sense of security for people.
Could there be a prettier security blanket than gold with its yellow glitter and shine? Today's investors, though, are after more than luster. Mark Williams is a risk management expert at Boston University.
Investors themselves are rushing in. There's no other ways in which investors can see getting high returns. So they're moving into gold and also to junk bonds again.
Williams calls it a gold bubble that'll eventually burst. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Boeing's new plane, the 787, is called the Dreamliner. But you got to wonder right about now whether the company maybe wishes it had named it something else. Because with all its extra costs, the design problems, and the delays, about the only dream left is that someday the plane might actually make somebody some money. The latest setback is that the Federal Aviation Administration has issued some preliminary rules for how far other planes are going to have to fly behind Boeing's new jets to stay safe. And at least initially, those other planes are going to have to keep their distance, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
When Boeing's Dreamliner took its first test flight in Seattle last year, there were cheers all around. But the ultra-fuel-efficient plane's already 3 years late, and the FAA's new safety rules are another setback. According to the Wall Street Journal, other aircraft will have to stay at least 10 miles behind the Dreamliner during landing. That's twice as far as for Boeing's current planes. The reason is something called wake turbulence. Imagine a cone of spinning air spiraling out behind a jet's wingtips. Bigger planes need more room behind them for safety. But airline analyst Daryl Jenkins doesn't think that'll cause bottlenecks at busy airports.
Look at JFK. You have big planes and regional jets and turboprops out on the runway at the same time, and controllers have an enormous amount of experience in spacing planes.
Aviation expert Kurt Grimm at the University of Maryland says government officials are being overly cautious.
And I think they're responding to public sentiment that regulators may have been a little lax, whether it's drilling for oil offshore, whether it's financial regulation, whether it's transportation safety.
The FAA says it might ease up on the new safety rules once the planes have been tested in flight next year. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Wall Street had some wings. Today we will have the details when we do the numbers. If you find yourself running late in the mornings and you want to grab a quick bite to eat on the way to work, you have no shortage of choices. Your local coffee shop or a donut place or, of course, fast food. 60% of that industry's growth the past 5 years has come from the morning rush. Notably absent up till now from the usual menu of Burger King and McDonald's, though, has been Wendy's. Peter O'Dowd reports from KJZZ in Phoenix.
Karen Huff just cracked an egg over a griddle. It spreads out and sizzles while she sprinkles it with sea salt.
And then we're going to break the yolk and just kind of let the white set up.
It's just after 8 o'clock, and cracking an egg at this time is not terribly surprising until you learn that Huff is the manager of a fast food restaurant. No more liquid yolks out of a carton. Wendy's has gone upscale.
While there's a lot of people who are doing breakfast right now, there's not very many that are doing it well.
Count the folks at Wendy's among them, according to Ken Caldwell, the company's chief marketing officer.
Wendy's has tested breakfast twice in our past in major efforts. Both of those failed.
Caldwell says past efforts failed because the food took too long to make, and it didn't taste good enough. This time around, they'll try a new menu with toasted egg sandwiches, paninis, smoked bacon, and fresh orange juice. You can find those items right now in three test cities, including Phoenix. Caldwell says all 6,300 Wendy's nationwide could offer the menu by the end of next year. But he says a big challenge will be convincing Wendy's owners to open early.
That's a cost to a franchisee. So what you have to show through your test market's results is that the sales and the profitability make it worth it.
Other chains have seen the value in breakfast. Subway has rolled out a morning menu. Even Taco Bell has jumped in with breakfast burritos. Morningstar analyst Jocelyn McKay says it's about time Wendy's made the move.
Being in the breakfast day part for any quick service restaurant right now is going to be key to driving your sales forward, especially as we're still languishing in the doldrums of a weak economy.
Analysts estimate up to a quarter of all fast food sales come in the breakfast rush. McKay says Wendy's will lag behind competitors like McDonald's if it cannot crack into that morning market.
To be successful in this arena, they need to have a very compelling offering. It needs to be different than what's already out there.
Start the chili, please.
Back at the Wendy's drive-thru in Phoenix, there is some indication the new menu is resonating with customers like Anna Franco.
I really like it. It's really good.
And what did you order today?
The fire-roasted burrito and then just orange juice.
Franco gives the cashier about $4, a bit less than she typically spends on breakfast at Jack in the Box. Before she drives off to work, Franco says she'll be back later in the week. And that's exactly what Wendy's needs to hear.
There you go. Thank you. You have a good day.
You too. Bye.
In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
There have been millions of foreclosures in this country since the recession started, not all of them on the up and up. In the past couple of weeks, three mortgage lenders have had to stop foreclosure proceedings because the paperwork was questionable at best. State officials have started taking a closer look at what's been happening and in some cases calling in the feds. One of those officials is Jennifer Bruner. She is the Ohio Secretary of State. Ms. Bruner, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here, Kai.
In a standard foreclosure, that is, in a legal foreclosure, there are a pile of documents, they are attested to and signed, and everybody knows in theory what's in them. What has your office discovered about what's been happening with a good share of the foreclosures these days?
My office has discovered that there have been a lot of shortcuts taken in notarizing documents that are required for foreclosure. At one financial institution, a group of eight notaries sit at tables and notarize 18,000 documents a month. What was described in the depositions was that the person who is signing the documents doesn't really have knowledge of what is in those documents. In some situations, I've seen examples where one individual signs 2,000 to 5,000 documents a day with an e-signature.
No matter how fast you read, if you're signing, 2,500 a day, you're not really sure what's inside those documents.
I think it would be nearly impossible.
So far, we've had Ally Financial, we've had J.P. Morgan Chase, and then just this past Friday, Bank of America saying they were going to halt foreclosures in some 23 states across the country. It does sort of sound like there are more shoes to drop in this.
It does. And what's very interesting is that on the 27th, on September 27th, Congress very quickly passed House Resolution 3808, and it requires that state and federal courts honor notarizations from another state as long as they were lawful in that state. It seemed innocuous at first, but when you really look into it and you look at what's happening out there with technology and mortgages and see that there are states that have very lax laws and allow for electronic notarization without even presenting in front of a notary, it seems very clear that there's an attempt of the banking industry to flank what's being discovered by consumers with a lot of indignation.
This is, it seems to me, not to be pejorative, but it's a paperwork problem, right? We had people not knowing what they were signing. We had notaries doing things, if not fraudulently, then out of neglect. It's a corruption of the paperwork, yes?
It is, except I can't necessarily blame the notaries. When you have situations like 18,000 documents processed by eight notaries in the period of a month, that's a company policy. Those employees are doing what they're told to do. And it's a paperwork problem, but it's a bigger problem that an institution that we depend on that's publicly traded would think that they can shortcut the laws of the states that they do business in.
Is anybody going to get their home back out of any of this?
That remains to be seen. The homeowner who's already been foreclosed upon, who's lost their home, who may go back and discover that it was done improperly, even against the law, would have the ability to file a motion in court under the civil rules to have the court review that case again. So I think it's a little soon in the process to see what the outcome will be, but it would be a good thing for everyone to come clean and everyone to work together to figure out how we can make it through this morass.
One of the reasons that capitalism works is because we are able to have faith in a transaction, that the seller has clear title to sell the property and the buyer will get clear title to buy. That process has been corrupted in real estate in this country, at least in part, by some of what's been going on.
And to put it really bluntly, that process has been corrupted by greed.
Jennifer Bruner is the Secretary of State of the state of Ohio. Jennifer, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up.
I think fans, you know, love to see offense. They love to see the ball hit far. They love to see the ball go over the wall. But also, I think fans love to see a home run being robbed by an outfielder.
The baseball playoffs start tomorrow, so we are going to start a new segment today, Freakonomics, the hidden side of everything, including why, as the postseason starts, you might not see so many home runs. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials piled on 193 points today, 1.8%, closed to 10,944. I can see 11,000 from here, buddy. NASDAQ climbed 55 points, 2.3%, ended at 2399. The S&P 500 added 23 points, 2%, closed at 1160. Bellwether stocks gained. Caterpillar plowed ahead 2.75% today. DuPont cleaned up 3%. Boeing nosed up 3.5% today. Bank stocks bulked up after JPMorgan Chase said the industry will beat estimates because of strong mortgage loan sales and higher interest income. JPMorgan Chase added 1.7% today. Apple polished up a 3.7% gain after one analyst said its stock was vastly underestimated. Google rose 3% today. The price for the 10-year T-notes rose. The yield fell to 2.47%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at Progressive.com. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com. Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. It's Nobel season. The prize in chemistry is announced in Stockholm. Fortune's Most Powerful Women Summit wraps up in Washington. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaks. And remember when you were a kid, you had to walk 5 miles through the snow to get to school? Or maybe you know someone who did. Time to pass it on. Tomorrow is Walk to School Day. It's for your health. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We got a rare treat today. I'm at Yankee Stadium sitting next to Stephen Dubner. Dubner, introduce yourself. Say hello to the people.
Hello, people. I'm Stephen Dubner. I'm co-author of the book Freakonomics, and I'm going to be bringing some Freakonomics right here to Marketplace.
So here we are, and this is great, and I'm having a good time, but the game doesn't start for like an hour and a half. Why are we at batting practice?
Let me tell you, batting practice is one of the best places to see home runs hit these days because there aren't as many being hit in the games anymore. There aren't as many runs being scored anymore. In fact, run scoring is down to about where it was 20 years ago. Now, any guesses as to why that might be?
I don't know. Pitching is better?
What would you say if I said steroids? Would you think, maybe with a lot of guys getting busted for steroids in the last few years, more steroids testing, has that affected the number of runs that are being scored and the number of home runs being hit? So I asked my buddy Steve Levitt, who's an economist at the University of Chicago, my co-author on Freakonomics, to look into the numbers, see what he could tell us.
Twice in the past decade, I have really tried to find evidence that, say, steroids matter in baseball. And both times I invested a lot of effort and ended up finding no evidence that steroids mattered.
Levitt is a data detective. He's caught cheating school teachers and sumo wrestlers just by going through the statistics they left behind. In baseball, he's come up short, but in the last few years, a string of home run studs have admitted to using banned substances. Congress has taken note. Testing has gotten tighter. While Levitt hasn't found the cheaters, there has been a big change in baseball. Scoring has plunged. Stat heads like Mitchell Lichtman say it's a sign the steroids era is over.
People will say it's the year of the pitcher or pitching is great or better.
This season has seen some extraordinary pitching, 5 no-hitters and 2 perfect games. But if you take a look beneath those numbers, you find something else is going on. Behind all those great pitchers are a bunch of unsung heroes, the fielders. Forget pitching. 2010 is the year of the glove.
There's probably more of an emphasis in the post-steroid era of players that are have speed and defense as primary attributes rather than hitting, slugging, hitting home runs.
Every year since 2006, the average number of runs scored by major league teams has dropped. But if you isolate the pitching stats, you see that pitchers themselves aren't any better than in years past. Fielders are the ones picking up the slack. The numbers show that fielders have gotten better at converting hits into outs, and this has created an opportunity.
One of the reasons that some teams are focusing on defense and defensive evaluation using these advanced metrics is because it's an undervalued commodity in baseball.
An undervalued commodity. With more steroids testing and penalties, it could be that teams are going out of their way to avoid players who might be using. Or it could simply be that defensive players weren't paid enough during the go-go steroid years. Now teams have found a way to get a different kind of bang for their buck. And here's what's interesting. While run scoring is down in the majors, it's up in the minors. What it looks like is that teams are promoting their best defensive players to the majors faster than they used to.
And I'm certainly proud and happy to hear that the defense is getting recognized at this time. Now, certainly, maybe I would have had a different kind of career if I was playing now.
Doug Glanville is a former Major League center fielder. He played 9 seasons with 3 teams during the heart of the steroid era. He was a great fielder. In fact, he ended his career on a streak of 293 consecutive games without an error. But Glanville wasn't a power hitter, and that, he says, hurt him during contract negotiations. It was painfully obvious that while defense wins games, offense pays the bills. Translation? Fans want home runs. Sitting in his team's dugout in San Diego, Padres manager Bud Black disagrees. Last offseason, his team focused on defense, which helped them go from a second-to-last place finish in 2009 to barely missing the playoffs this year.
I think fans, you know, love to see offense. They love to see the ball hit far. They love to see the ball go over the wall. But also, I think fans love to see a home run being robbed by an outfielder. And I think fans get a kick out of that as much as they do a home run.
Whatever the case, everybody's going to have to get used to games with lower scores, which means that if you want to see a lot of home runs, you'd better show up at the ballpark a couple hours early for batting practice.
All right, Dubner, but wait, hang on just like 1 second, all right?
Yeah, all right.
Here we are back at Yankee Stadium, batting practice. I have to ask you the money question. Besides higher salaries for defensive players, where are we going with this?
Well, it's a good lesson, something that economists can teach us. Whenever you change a rule, whether it's in baseball or banking, people are going to change their behavior in response to it. Some of the rules that have changed in baseball, especially having to do with steroids, have produced a lot more good gloves defense. I have a feeling that with the banking regs that have changed in the last year or so, that I'm going to be hearing a lot from you in the next year, stories about how bankers' behaviors changed. Bankers hiding their home runs, bankers bulking up on whatever kind of performance-enhancing drug they can find.
That was Stephen Dubner, our Freakonomics correspondent, passing a late summer afternoon with me at Yankee Stadium a couple of weeks ago. We've got links to all the statistics he was using to decipher the mystery of the disappearing home run and a new podcast at FreakonomicsRadio.com. Dubner and the Freakonomics team is going to be back here in just a couple of weeks. How many of you woke up to your clock radios this morning, heard the word graphene in the newscast someplace, and went, wait, what? Thanks to today's announcement of the Nobel Prize in Physics, you are now a whole lot smarter about that new form of carbon. For those keeping score, though, there are still 4 Nobels to go. Chemistry tomorrow, then literature, the Peace Prize, and on Monday, economics. Commentator and comedian Andy Borowitz has some thoughts.
Remember who won last year's Nobel Prize for Economics? Well, don't beat yourself up. No one does. The top prize in its field, and a year later, the winner's totally forgotten? That's unheard of. Well, okay, the Hurt Locker. But still, there's no question that the Nobel for Economics has lost its juice. It's not surprising. Winning the Nobel during the worst economic slump since the Great Depression, it's like being named most valuable player by the Pittsburgh Pirates. If there's really such an economics genius out there, why are we all eating ramen noodles? Even a recent winner whose name I can remember hasn't generated a lot of heat for the prize. Paul Krugman of the New York Times. Now, I dig the Krug. And when he won in 2008, I was like, the Nobel is back. Bad call. Krugman proceeded to write a series of interminable columns criticizing the size of President Obama's stimulus package. Let's just say they didn't go viral. So with the announcement of the Nobel coming up, the Brain Trust in Sweden needs to think about a serious reboot. It's time to make the Nobel Prize for Economics sexy again. It should go to someone with star power who actually understands this rotten economy well enough to make money in it. Number one on my short list, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. Now, he has a hit movie out, and he's said to be worth $6.9 billion. On the downside, if he wins a Nobel for his ideas, it might turn out later that they're not his ideas. Well, that leaves me with my second choice, Michael Sorrentino, better known to viewers of Jersey Shore as The Situation. Now, his economic credentials are impeccable. According to news sources, he is set to earn $5 million this year. That's almost $1 million per ab. The Situation doesn't just deserve the Nobel Prize for Economics. He should get a MacArthur Genius Grant. And one thing's for sure, a year from now, we won't have trouble remembering who won.
Andy Borowitz is the creator of the Borowitz Report. Who's on your short list for the Economics Nobel? Six-pack abs or not? Drop us a line with your nominations. Just visit our website, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals on the web at putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, a lesson in how going green can come with some corporate pitfalls. Frito-Lay, which is owned by PepsiCo, announced today it's getting rid of the plant-based, quote, 100% compostable bags that it's been using for its Sun Chips line. Apparently, and this is true, they're too noisy. Customers complained, and Sun Chips sales are down 11% the past year. Green, I guess, is good. Sales, much, much better, I suppose. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow up 193 points, 1.8%. The NASDAQ up 55 points. The S&P 500 up 23 points. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this broadcast, immigration here, immigration there.
The point is you need a cap to get the overall level of immigration down. And we need that because our public services are under strain. Our communities are under some strain, some of them.
Keeping a campaign promise in the UK, I'm Kai Ryssdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.